elephants, turtles, and a big wooden fish today on Arts Live and Local. I'm Cindy Price, sitting in for Carol Newman. Carol is fine and sends you her best wishes. The Tillicum House, from which Coast Community Radio broadcasts, is closed to its many volunteer programmers for their safety during this quarantine, because it's such a great deal of work to keep the studios sanitized between shows. Carol looks forward to returning when the studios reopen. Today on Arts, Not Live, But Still Local, we'll talk with multimedia artist Jill Mulholland, Hip Fish publisher and editor, singer and community activist Dinah Urell, and Jeff Daly, bringer of joy. First, we're going to hear an excerpt from a small business forum sponsored by Clatsop Economic Development Resources, known as CEDR, and held via Zoom on Thursday, April 30th. The forum was open to the public, and there was a question and answer period. Oregon state officials are discussing reopening efforts within six specific business sectors: restaurants and food services, retail, personal services like hair and nail salons and tattoo parlors, childcare, transit, and outdoor recreation, including parks. Much of the discussion at this business forum centered around details that might affect these separate sectors. One participant raised a question about the arts. Kevin Leahy of CEDR answered first, with a follow-up by Oregon State Senator Betsy Johnson. Here's the full exchange.
Next question. Are the arts included anywhere in the six designated sectors?
We
know.
Yeah.
That deserved a better answer than just no. They have not been called out as a one of the six designated sectors. I presume that they could be shoehorned, and this would be disrespectful in my view, into outdoor recreation and leisure. The arts are incredibly important, and it has been my experience in the legislature that when we get into bad economic times, the arts are the first to get thrown out of the bus. When Clatsop County reinvented themselves after the loss of timber revenue, fishing, and the traditional natural resource economy, reinvented ourselves as hospitality, leisure, arts, foodie, culture. We're heavily dependent on the arts, and we have a reputation for the arts, and many cultural events built around the arts, Fisher Poets, that kind of stuff in Astoria. And so I just want you to know that I continue to advocate that the arts not be forgotten. There is a conversation about, could the corpus of the cultural trust be invaded to help some of the arts organizations? Then the question comes, who qualifies and who doesn't? Our big flagship arts organizations like the Portland Art Museum, Shakespeare, the High Desert Museum, the Oregon Historical Society, do they come front in the queue? Do they come later because they have greater revenue generating through richer patrons and more generous patrons? But the I'm not sure that the state has really taken into account how important the arts are to Oregon's overall character and our ability to generate revenue. I know that there is an effort by one of my former legislative colleagues right now to try to find some financial support for venues that historically have hosted art gatherings, whether it's live theater, music. But there is no specific call out for any kind of relief for the arts. And I should not have been so abrupt in my answer. But I think it is incumbent upon all of us who value the art connection to Clatsop County to continue to beat the drum for the fact that if we level the horizon in Oregon and we are denuded of the arts, we are a much less attractive place for business recruitment, and I would submit business recovery.
State Senator Betsy Johnson speaking out for the value of the arts to the state of Oregon and the county of Clatsop. Coming up next, artist Jill Mulholland on Arts, Not Live, But Still Local.
Born to the big time.
daddy's line with his daddy's name. Taught him to be the prince of tents. Vera, she may be a star, his daddy said, but I'd be a liar if I said she was the one who paid the rent. 'Cause the show goes on and the rings are filled, and that's a row and more. The show goes on, and the rings are filled, and that's a row, and bones are healed. Just take all of it with you when you go, king of the show. A new home will treat you well, and you've lines to give, and dreams to sell. Some countries love to crown a king. Found himself a pretty wife, threw a drink right in his eye. Ginger curls, big diamond wedding ring. And the show goes on, and the rings are filled, and that's a row, and bones are healed. And you never
Welcome back to Arts Not Live But Still Local on Coast Community Radio. I'm Cindy Price. Jill Mulholland is a multimedia artist and lighting designer and spent some time as an archaeologist. Jill moved to Astoria about 3 years ago and now lives on the Long Beach Peninsula. We talked at the Astoria Visual Arts Gallery on Saturday, May 2nd. Jill Mulholland, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for asking me, Cindy.
How was your trip across the bridge? Are there any roadblocks anywhere?
It was pretty gray, and it was kind of wet with white caps, but it wasn't pouring, so that was good.
And no problems having Washington plates in Oregon?
Not so far, no.
Jill, what are you doing today that you wouldn't be doing if we were in a pandemic? And what would you be doing?
Well, it's Saturday, so I'm not working. I still have a job, and I'm very grateful for that, so I'm lucky. But I don't really know if you're going to like the answer to this, Cindy, because my life really hasn't changed that much. I work remotely from a nonprofit office in Chicago, Monday through Friday, and then I make art. And there was a little bit of a lull when this pandemic first hit, when everything was kind of weird, and I wasn't making any art, but since then I've been making art, so that's what I do. I work, and I make art. And I come into town to grocery shop like I always do, and I don't know, I think I might be kind of a semi-recluse, so things aren't all that different for me.
Tell us what it is that you do with your work.
I work for a professional organization called the International Association of Lighting Designers. It's like the Bar Association for lawyers. Architectural lighting designers go to conferences and trade shows, and we put on some of these conferences and trade shows, all of which have been canceled for the year, so I have no trips. Hooray! And I work for the nonprofit one, the 501c3, and I run all of their programs. So we have travel stipends and scholarships, and I manage the board and do all the day-to-day stuff that goes along with that.
Other than the lack of travel, what other impacts have you heard about that are going on for lighting designers around the country?
Oh, well, lighting designers are, in case you don't know, architects build the buildings, design the buildings, and lighting designers tell them what lights to put where. It's called lighting specification. So it's a pretty highly technical job. I used to be one. And it depends on construction. So right now, there are many lighting designers that are still very busy because they're still in the jobs that were in some form of completion. And there are small firms and medium-sized firms and large-sized firms. The small firms are hurting because eventually that, and they call it the pipeline, that pipeline will dry up. And then there'll be a big lull, and then there'll be no work. And so right now they're dealing with their kids at home and working remotely and adjusting to all that. The IALD has seminars, webinars every week that I've watched those. And so far people are, they seem to be having a good attitude and coping well, but it's going to change. And all my trips being canceled, that means that the income that we had from the trade show and the income that we had from the conferences, we don't have that income. So we're okay right now. And then, you know, next year, we're looking at millions of dollars in income that we don't get.
Are you considered an independent contractor, or are you an employee?
I'm an employee.
You're an employee. So were you able to get unemployment insurance?
Well, I could. I'm still working. I could. I think that probably, I'm hoping that they'll just reduce me down to part-time. But, you know, we'll see. The only difference maybe in my job is that now all my coworkers in Chicago, they want to talk to each other. Like once a week we have this Wine Day Friday and we all go on a big Zoom thing and people, you know, drink and make office small talk, which I'm not very good at small talk. So yesterday during mine I just walked down on the beach and filmed it so they could see that. But so that's a difference. But and I think they might respect me more as a remote worker, you know, and understand what that entails when you're not actually in the office and the day-to-day stuff.
Right. Now let's turn to your art. The last exhibit that you had at the Astoria Visual Arts, maybe actually the big exhibit, was when you were an artist in residence, and you had your big lighting display there, which was quite interesting. And then what was the last one here? You had a few pieces of your light confetti. Let's talk about light confetti for a moment.
Okay. Light confetti are these pieces that I designed that either sit in the window and they use sunlight and they reflect off all of this broken glass, and the broken glass reflects these dots onto the ceiling, and they move across the wall and the ceiling with the angle of the sun during the day and also through the seasons of the year. They can also hang in the window and spin, but then people tell me that that's like a disco ball, which doesn't make me happy. But I do make spinners because people seem to like them.
I like the spinners. I have one in my sunroom, and I like the way it spins when the light is just right through the yard, and then there will be these colored lights that go up the trunks of trees, which is quite special.
Yeah, yeah. I can appreciate that people like that and get over my disco ball thing, but I like the ones in the windowsill better.
I'd like also to talk a little bit about your dinosaur necklaces.
Oh, the elephant necklaces.
Elephant necklaces, yes.
One of the reasons I moved here is because my friend Bert lives here. He's an electrical engineer that I used to work with when I worked in Portland as a lighting designer. And his parents bought his beach house in 1957, and they collected all these wooden net floats that washed up on the beach. And then they were out in the rain for like 50 or 60 years, so all the grains raised, and they were rotting. So when I was here in 2007, I asked Bert if I could have those, and he said yes. And I took them home, and I made them into a giant necklace because they looked like beads to me. But I didn't really like the spacers in between the wooden buoys that I painted. So this second round, I found a whole another batch of net floats when I moved here 3 years ago, and I asked Bert if I could have them, and he said yes. And then I remembered I had 217 pool balls, and the pool balls were exactly the right size for the spacers between the buoys, so I started drilling them. And it turns out I have pool balls from all different times and ages, and some of them were made of stuff that explodes. Now I can't remember exactly what it is. Anyway, I set the dust on fire and kind of blew out the frame that held my pool balls, but then Bert felt sorry for me, and so I had no patience, so he drilled them. He drilled the rest of them for me. I set them up. And so I made them into, I call them elephant necklaces because they're about the right size, I think. Lisa Smith, she was in Thailand, and she went to an elephant reserve, and I asked her if she could find out the measurement, if an elephant had a necklace, and they were like 8 to 10 feet. So, and that's what I made. So I think I made like 8 or 10 of them.
And then there was one other element to this exhibit that you had as an artist in residence. There were bones. Some were wrapped, some were skeletons.
Yes. I used to be an archaeologist, and I was always looking at the ground, trying to find out where the sites were. These were usually lithic scatters for in the Forest Service in Northern California and in Belize and different places. And so when I stopped being an archaeologist, I was still looking at the ground, picking stuff up. And so a lot of the work that I did was in the desert, and so I would find these cow bones, and I would pick them up. And then I had a pretty big pile. And one of my students, his parents had a ranch in Texas. He did a project out of cow bones, and then he gave them to me. So I had a lot of them. So I rhinestoned some skulls. I had about, I think, 6 skulls or so. And then I wrapped these bones with this paracord, and they turned into, like, patterns. People asked me if I embroidered it, and I didn't. I just wrapped them. Embroidering would take patience, and I have no patience. And so I rhinestoned the skulls, and I wrapped the bones, and I think I used bones in one of the elephant necklaces, but I didn't like the way that looked, so I unstrung that one and did it again.
Now, I had the opportunity recently to visit you in your studio in Long Beach, and you're doing something entirely different.
I am.
You're preparing for a show here in the AVA Gallery in August or September?
August.
August. What are you doing?
Well, it seems that I've been collecting these large-scale images from magazines since the mid-80s. I don't really know why, but I had a really big box of them. Then when I lived in Albuquerque, there was the best thrift store ever around the corner from me, and I found all these maps for like $20, and the maps were from like the 1940s, 50s, 60s, big. There's one of Brazil, one of Africa, India. There's National Geographic maps from World War II, and they were a big enough size that my large-scale images that I collected would fit on there. So I'm making these collages, and they're giant, and they're kind of weird, but I'm having a pretty good time. I call it the Goddess series because all the collages feature women in some area, and I think I collected a calendar from an Asian grocery store that had a bunch of young women posing with fruit. And so I have the Asian fruit goddesses. I think there's 8 or 9 of them. And then when body paint first came out in the 90s, I got a couple of calendars from there, and the women were spray painted with body paint. So they also anchor a number of these collages. I'm on collage number 27, there'll be 29. I didn't know there was going to be that many, but that's how many big maps I have.
What size are we talking?
The largest one is 4 feet by 3 feet, and the smallest one is probably 2 feet by 18 inches maybe, but they're all the USGS, they do a bunch of topographic maps, and so they're probably about 3 feet by 2 feet, and the Asian fruit goddesses are on the USGS topo maps. I don't know why. I think proportionally it worked out well.
Let's talk a little bit about Astoria and its lighting. If you had your free run of Astoria, what would you do to light up Astoria?
Now, that's a rather unfair question to give me no notice about Cindy Price. You know, Astoria is this kind of funny combination of urban, because these buildings were urban 100 years ago, but remote and rural. And so I think if I could do anything, I would probably light the buildings from the inside so they glowed, and like the Astor Building. You could do that in different colors, not like the Empire State Building, but you could have like different themes and stuff. And you're just asking me, so please, anyone who hears this, don't tell me all the practical reasons why I could never do this, because I'm just making this up. But light, when light glows through glass, it's really very introspective. They do it with stained glass in church. It makes you happy. So I think I would turn Astoria's buildings into like a big jewel necklace and light all those buildings up so they glowed.
Tell me about the difference between light in the desert, which you've spent a lot of time in, and now here in the on the coast in the Pacific Northwest.
My answer for this would have changed if you had asked me before I came to live here. I did some work in Alaska probably 15 or 20 years ago. I went there because sometimes you learn the most about things when you go to its opposite. So you go to Alaska, which is pretty dark most of the time, and you learn a lot about light. And I think in some ways Astoria is somewhat like that, because we have these longer winters and these long, dark days. When the sun finally comes out, people like run out of the buildings and almost like shake your hand. Everyone's almost euphoric. So in the desert, desert is beautiful, and there's so much light, so the shadows are incredible, right? Really black shadows. Shadows here are kind of wimpy. You don't get a lot of shadows in the grayness, and when the sun finally comes up, because we're at a high latitude, the shadows are on an angle, and so they're a little bit lighter. But I think the best thing about Astoria is that people really appreciate the light here. And like my light confetti when I lived in Albuquerque, I saw my light confetti every day, and that was great. I learned a lot about it. Here, when I come home and the light confetti is working and there's lights all over my ceiling, it makes me happy. And in Albuquerque, I just sort of took that for granted. So I think less light here makes people more appreciative. And people here know about light. Like, they don't look at me like I'm from outer space when I say that I'm a light artist or I was a lighting designer. They may not know exactly what that is, but they know what light is and what it can do.
In full disclosure, Jill and I are friends. We've been on the board of Astoria Visual Arts for a number of years, but not that many years, Jill. I think you have been here on the coast for 3 years now. And we've talked about this a little bit, about how you found it a very welcoming place.
Yes. One of the benefits of working remotely, which I have for 18 and a half years, is that I can move around to new places. And I didn't really ever think of that consciously when I got the job. It was kind of a fluke that I got the job. But I was in Texas for 10 years at Texas A&M, and that was long enough for Texas, although I had a good time. And I moved to Albuquerque. And then I moved from Albuquerque to Astoria. And Albuquerque was a beautiful place, and people were nice, but there was no sense of community there for me. Everything I tried to do, volunteer, grants, teaching, everything, was no. And I came here to Astoria, and people are, well, first of all, I'm kind of normal here. And that's so refreshing, because there were so many loony artists that I'm like, hey, I'm almost boring, and I enjoy that. But people have been open and warm and supportive, and I feel a sense of home here, as I haven't felt since I left Oregon in 1999.
Well, I'm so glad you found your way here, Jill Mulholland. You have never been boring to me. And I hope that the gallery will be open to the public by August, the second Saturday in August for Art Walk.
August 8th.
August 8th, so that we can see these fancy new collages that you've been working on for the past little while. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Cindy.
Artist and lighting designer Jill Mulholland. Jill's exhibit of vibrant collages that she's calling the Goddess Series will open at the AVA Gallery on August 8. We'll be back with Hipfish publisher and editor Dinah Urell after this short break. I'm Cindy Price on Arts Not Live But Still Local on Coast Community Radio. Dinah Urell is the publisher and editor of Hipfish magazine. She's a marvelous jazz singer, and she's a community activist. We also caught up with her at the AVA Gallery on Saturday, May 2nd.
K-moon is shining bright, K-moon in the night, K-moon keeps me company. K-moon, K-moon. Telecom house is shaking tonight. Radio waves, they're out of sight. 91.9, you're so fine. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Turn the radio on.
Yeah, baby, thank you for that.
Yeah.
I thought you were just down at your shop working on Hipfish, but you're writing songs.
Well, I often do. Because, you know, it's a great space, great acoustics in there, and yeah.
Well, it's one of the things I miss a lot is being able to hear you sing. The last time was at another gallery. It was at Riversea Gallery when you sang Happy Birthday to Noel Thomas.
Oh, yeah.
That brought tears to the eyes of pretty much everyone there.
Oh.
Yeah, thank you. The Hip Fish shop is about a block and a half from here. Mm-hmm. And you told me that you were in there working on the May issue. Another
yes.
April issue was the No Events issue.
Yes.
Is this No Events issue number two?
Obviously, there are events going on, right?
What's going on?
Well, all the Zooming.
Yes. Are you Zooming?
I've been Zooming.
Is that how?
And I've gotten my Zoom meetings mixed up, like what time is one Zoom meeting and one is the next, and, you know.
Is that how the issue is going together this month?
No, you know, we're doing, like writers are doing phone calls and done some Zoom things with people, but the good old-fashioned phone, you know.
Yeah. So what else are you doing this month that you would not have been doing in February?
Let's see, going crazy, having ennui, wondering if I'm going to make it through this.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. What will be the focus of the May issue of Hip Fish?
Well, we'll be doing some endorsements for the primaries. Yeah, that will be the main focus. And there will be some stories on some authors and artists. And this last issue was, it just turned out that every single piece was COVID-related. I mean, it's affecting everything to the minute and infinite degree.
In your, I guess, publisher's note that you have in each issue, you said, this time unilaterally, when we come back, the collective vibe is saying, not your regular programming. I'm seeing a turtle. How about you?
Yeah.
So what are you seeing now?
Yeah, that the turtle.
Meaning?
Well, you know, I think that's actually a great species to relate or to be a metaphor for all of us as we slowly step forward. The turtle is like such an amazing animal. You know, it can live under a refrigerator for 3 months without any food or water. I know that's where my turtles went when I was a little girl. Turtles are just a beautiful, you know, they've got the shell, they've got their self-sustaining, and they move with, you know, or I guess like a goat also, you know. Where the goat steadily climbs the mountain with each step by step.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, as we begin to move through these phases, that these phases will be important not only for the protection of health, but also for our psyches. And perhaps that's something that will be one of those changes that we can't quite imagine yet. Is how we'll become, you know, well, you know, our goals keep us going, you know, but maybe we'll be less, you know, in a hurry to complete all those goals and to enjoy the process and to enjoy each other while we're doing it.
One of the reasons that I wanted you here today is not only because you're a wonderful impromptu jazz singer and you publish this beautiful monthly magazine, Hip Fish, is that you're also the owner and operator of Kala Gallery in downtown Astoria. And Kala is not only an art gallery, it is a creative space. You have everything from theater, music, visual art, I don't know what else.
You should be there after hours,
Cindy. Yeah. Well, obviously Kala has been closed like everything else since sort of mid-late March, and do you have plans for opening?
Well, we do have something coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I can announce this. There will be a Pride Gala.
Okay, tell us more.
There will be a Pride Gala over the same weekend that it has been, Pride Festival.
That's in June, right?
Yes.
June,
like 13, 14.
Mid-June, yeah.
Yeah, 12, 13, and it will be televised. It will be on YouTube. And there will be footage from past parades and festivals and performances. And in addition to new performances, we'll shoot some of those at Kala, and I think people have creative ideas about where they might do their performance.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, we'll look forward, and we will be able to do that with social distancing.
Mm-hmm. Have any idea whether by mid-June you could have some sort of parade where, I mean, you're 6 feet apart and wearing masks, but in all one's glory and celebration?
Yeah, you know, I think that the Pride organization really wants to do this televised performance and retrospective. So that's important. I could not say. Yeah. I could not say at this time.
Yeah. There might be people listening who don't know what Pride is, so please tell us.
Pride, if you don't know what Pride is, boy, you are really living in the dark ages. Pride is the summer celebration of the LGBTQI community that's been going on for, 40, 50 years now? And it happens in every city, and it happens here in our rural Astoria, our rural North Coast, our rural Columbia Pacific region. And it's become an amazing 3-day festival, and people come from all over to attend the block party.
You probably, just if not, nothing else, in the process of putting together the May issue, talked to a lot of people, writers, artists, yeah, of creatives of all sorts. How's everybody doing?
You know, everybody has the same, I think, this sort of collective consciousness, like I said, ennui, where we're feeling the weirdness, but everyone, I think, is dealing with it in their own way, to always just wake up, smell the coffee, get on with your day, whatever that might look like.
Just keep going, because what's the alternative, really?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and in many ways, again, this is a learning path for us. It's difficult, but hopefully we do reap benefits from it.
So what have you been doing creatively?
Not a lot. Well, okay. What I've been doing is learning to meditate.
How are you doing that? Do you have an app?
Sometimes I use an app. It's called Insight Timer on whatever. It's one of those apps, and you can choose all kinds of different music. Sometimes I join like a group meditation that's, you know, we're all meditating at 11 o'clock. You know, it's like, then there's those meditations where it's like, okay, we're all going to heal the earth today. So, you know, and then, you know, I find myself going, okay, I'm not quite sure my brain is doing this right. This feels like a lot. I don't know if I can heal the whole earth today. I see it. It's healed now. One thing that I have found helpful, and it was just like enlightening, is Alan Watts.
Good old Alan Watts.
Good old Alan Watts. I was introduced to him in the late 70s, but it was very strange and it scared me. We won't go into that. But you can even just go to YouTube, and there's one of his great, it's a short, it's like a 15-minute talk about meditation. It's called Listen. And today the Alan Watts organization has put it together with like background music and whatnot, and he explains this very simple like explanation of meditation. And when you listen to that, you just like go, wow, you know, okay, just, it's each person's individual experience. And I think if anyone is interested in meditation, which I think is, it's such a great time to do that right now, because we all have to raise our vibrations. This is the message from the metaphysical people. Mm. You know, just sitting in silence with your breath and going inward, you connect with that part of ourselves that we forget. You know, we're always like the functioning part, right? But what makes us function? It's all of the other stuff that we have, the whole being. And it can be a struggle because the mind comes in, but you learn how to pass through it. And it's a wonderful exploration. And even when I struggle with it at times, when I'm finished, I'll be like, huh, where did I go? What did I do? Whatever I did, I feel more connected to myself now.
And that helps get through the rest of the day,
yeah,
all of the stuff.
Does.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what other kind of stuff is it that you're having to deal with? I know that's such a wide question. Let me ask you this. Is it any harder or easier to put hip fish together when you cannot?
I thought it was going to be easier, and it was that first issue was very difficult. You know, well, I had to cut out 8 pages, the cultural arts sections.
Mm.
And which one of those pages, where was I going to cut it, and what, and where, and how is this going to look restructured? And I'd sit there and look at the computer and just be like, you know, wow. I think I spent a lot of time just like,
thus the meditation.
Yeah, right, yes. And I think that this next time around it will be like, okay, got that figured out.
So there's still the 8 pages are will be missing from May.
Yeah.
Are you hearing on the grapevine, what are people gearing up to do for June at all?
You know, I mixed up one of those Zoom meetings the other day, which was the performing arts organizations. And they'll be meeting again, and I don't really know. You know, it's like everybody, it's like these steps. I think the scary part is that once you do open, you have to maintain this social distancing. Well, that will make it practically impossible to financially
open.
Yeah.
And run a business.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And thankfully, my landlords with the Occident building have been very understanding, and everyone's trying to work together and figure it out together. And I know that eventually, you know, we'll get up and running again, you know, and then we have that other, the coming back, you know. And I will say that Pluto, Saturn, and Jupiter were a major conjunction. And Pluto is like the mass generational planet. And together with Jupiter, which is expansion, is like, oh, let's like expand this thing through the masses. Well, they're all now finally going retrograde in June, which is good. I think that's going to give us an opening. But they are coming back in late fall, coming back together for a couple months. Mm. So is that interesting? The same configuration happened at the Spanish flu and the AIDS outbreak.
Well, that suggests a certain amount of caution should be taken in between now and when they return in,
right,
in the fall.
You know, but we have to go on, you know, and like, I guess, you know, build up your immunities and stay safe. But at some point, we just have to go forward. You know, we can't
hide under the refrigerator forever.
That's right. The turtle will eventually come out.
Dinah Urell, you are such a joy. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Cindy. Thank you so much. I had all these other things listed that I was going to talk about.
Go ahead and tell me.
I just wanted to say that, let's see, because you asked, like, what are artists doing? And I had talked to Sid DeLuca recently, and he said, I'm finally back doing a whole new series of collage. And I know that Judith Altruda is writing a book. Well, she just recently finished an art book, and she herself found the lost art of Native American artist Eugene Landry. Mm-hmm. She found it in a shed.
Of course.
She found a whole collection of mid-century painting in a shed. She was given a grant, and that she's taken all the art and now working with, like, the Washington Humanities. There was going to be a show in June, the showing of the art. That's been canceled. But there's a color, she put together a color art book which catalogs the art and his life and who he was. Now that she's finished that, she started working on an actual book, which is her story about finding the art and her life, you know, beginning to understand the tribes there. So it's going to be, you know, great. But it's great because she's like, yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm doing it. You know, even though everything's difficult, I'm still able to continue with my project here.
Anything else?
Well, I know that the North Coast Chorale that I'm a part of, we're going to be getting to, as soon as we can, we're going to be getting back to the performance that was going to happen like a week after everything shut down. Lux Aeterna, which is this beautiful modern Latin, I'm not going to say mass, I forgot what it is, but it's long, and it's Latin, and it's modern. And we're deciding on a time when we will be able to do that. And I guess we better hurry. We don't want to do it next year. We want to do it before we can't do it again. I don't know. You know,
yeah.
Who knows? Let's hope that doesn't happen. But if it does, oh, what the hell? We'll be prepared.
I hope so. Thanks again, Dinah.
Okay, thank you, Cindy.
A song and a wide-ranging talk with Dinah Urell, publisher and editor of Hipfish. The magazine is out today, May 8th. You can find it at your local grocer and convenience store and at some pot shops, from the Long Beach Peninsula to Tillamook. I'm Cindy Price. This is Arts, not live, but still local, on Coast Community Radio. We'll be right back after a short break with Jeff Daly, bringer of joy. To describe Jeff Daly, Emmy Award-winning cameraman, preserver of some of Astoria's most eclectic history through the restoration of the original backward-driving clown car and the creation of the Astoria Underground Tours, brother who at long last found his cherished sister, Molly, Illuminart, the Joy Train, the Glam Tram. Jeff's latest treat brings him back to his documentarian days, a pop-up drive-in for one of Astoria's notables.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. That sounded right.
Where else but Astoria would you find a Jeff Daly, a Helmut John, and a crowd of locals in a downtown parking lot practicing social distancing on the last night of April during the pandemic, out to celebrate the first plein air showing of Daly's movie tribute to our most famous homeless character on the side of the American Legion building. Where else but Astoria?
That's Donna Quinn. Helmut John, Astoria is home. That was the final little name to the title that Kenny Hansen from Astoria Police gave it to us. I thought it was perfect.
It's really a beautiful and touching documentary, and I learned a number of things about Helmut John that I didn't know from all of his years of being here. What gave you the idea, Jeff?
Well, I've actually, you know, Helmut John is such an interesting character. How could you not see him and know of him and want to take pictures of him and talk to him? Because you just are attracted by him. I've been photographing him for probably about 3 years. I always photograph him on Christmas and other holidays when I'm out and about and see him out and about. And I've wanted to do something with him, and I wasn't quite sure what it was. But when this whole coronavirus thing popped up, I realized this was going to be the vehicle for the film that I wanted to do on him, the coronavirus through his eyes. Here's a guy that's already isolated from the world, that doesn't have a home to live in, lives from day to day, not quite sure where he's going to eat. How does he survive in this whole atmosphere? Somebody that is an Astoria favorite, but also somebody that's literally living on the streets from day to day. And I just thought it became the perfect vehicle to be able to show a film, the coronavirus, through his eyes, where we might have a chance to learn about what the virus is doing to affect our lives, but also learn a little bit about those that will be in need, because there's going to be many more homeless people unfortunately, on the streets after this whole thing is over.
That seems very possible. You did all of the film, the cinematography, and the writing. How did the writing come about?
Well, I had originally taken an article that was printed in the Forest Grove newspaper that was done about 5 years ago on John. And that was really the only information I even had on John, because there's really nothing that's been published much about him, just little bits and pieces. So this article was sort of a look at him and his family and where he lives in Forest Grove, and I sort of made that my script. But it had holes, and it was also a four-year-old article, so I needed to update it. And I started doing some writing on it, and I'm not a very good writer, but luckily I ran into Linda Pledge, and I said, "What are you doing?" And she says, "I got a little time," and so I gave her the article, and she took it and word scripted it and dressed it up and cleaned it up and gave us a great little script to work off.
First thing about this is that it's a pop-up drive-in. We have a drive-in movie theater now in downtown Astoria.
We do.
That is really terrific.
Over there in that hole that Cindy, you and I and Ray and have worked on so hard over the years to try and cover up and to make that place a little more attractive when we have our out-of-towners coming. Perhaps this is another alternative way to do it, is to use it for a gathering spot, but for nighttime, it's dark. Nobody can see the hole. But it's a wonderful spot, especially with nobody parking downtown right now. We have got ourselves a built-in drive-in.
What are the plans for future showings?
Well, we are, you can go to our website, which is the pop-up website. We're also on Facebook, but what we do is we're going through Eventbrite, and people are allowed or able to reserve a parking spot. I think we can put in Ray and I figured about 35 cars maybe after our two times we've done it to see how it works. It works out well. So we're reserving spots. The film's for free. It's no charge to anybody. We're asking a donation be given, which goes to the United Way. We're doing about $150 each night we show the film in terms of donations. So they're excited to get that, and those funds will then go to people in need on the streets.
There's also, like any good drive-in movie, there are a few things that happen before the film starts. There's a PSA, which is quite clever. Tell us about your PSA.
Well, you go to a movie, you got to see what the upcoming attractions are. Well, we just sort of took some of our favorite little videos that we've done. We have the Astoria Shakes, which is a video I did a couple weeks ago of an alternative to shaking hands, because we're not allowed to do that anymore. So we came up with a little visual contest on that. We have a rap song because I wanted to make sure that we have the kids understanding what they should be doing during this period. And we basically took all of our output lines that we didn't use in the Astoria Shakes video, and I gave it to Emily Gray Rivera, and she took it and wrote it into a rap song, which her kids then performed for us.
Who are those kids?
That's Emily's kid, Sam, and Chuck was the other kid, one of his best friends in school. So, yeah, we just went downtown Astoria one night, and it just stood in the middle of the street, and we knocked out ourselves a little rap song.
C-O-R-O-N-A-A.
Yeah.
Cool.
Stay 6 feet away.
Jeff Daly, thank you so much for coming in today. Jeff Daly also has the Joy Train that I hope you know about already. You really do bring a lot of joy to Astoria.
The Joy Train's going to Forest Grove.
No,
yes,
not for real, forever.
For real, no. We've had so many people in the Forest Grove area wanting to see this film. I talked to John last night, and I said, "John, you want to go to Forest Grove and watch the film?" And he goes, "Yes, I do." And I said, "All right, we'll get you a cab. I'm going to get him a cab, take him to Forest Grove." He has already figured out a place, a building that has a side and a parking lot. So, yes, we're going to go to Forest Grove. John will be there as a guest, and we'll show the movie there to the folks, which I call his sister city.
That reminds me now, at 5 o'clock, Astorians know about the Fort George steam whistle that goes off 5 o'clock every weekday, and you've been joining the Joy Train's steam whistle and bell along with that, but I believe you have a purpose for that.
Well, people like to supposedly howl or bang pans or things of that sort at 8 o'clock. I just sort of thought that we would just continue on with the 5 o'clock whistle, the end of the day, but just also sort of a celebration and a nod to those that are putting out so much, those that are still working today. And I go to different neighborhoods, blow the whistle, get the kids to come out and see the bubbles. It brings smiles to the faces. I did it yesterday, and I had at least a dozen kids on the street waiting for 5 o'clock to hear that whistle blow and to see the bubbles. So well, it's just, you know, we need to lighten up a little bit here and not be socially distanced, because unfortunately we're becoming unsocially distanced now. Let's all stay together and be friends on the wall during this time.
I'm all for that. Thank you so much again, Jeff Daly, for coming in today.
Carol, good seeing you.
I hope to see Carol sometime soon.
Showtimes for Jeff Daly's documentary Helmet John, Astoria is Home are scheduled for Friday and Saturday nights at 8:30 p.m. from now through the summer. You can find out more on Facebook at Pop-Up Drive-In and more about Jeff Daly and his many passions at www.oldastoria.com. Thanks to Jill Mulholland, Dinah Urell, and Jeff Daly for their time in making today's Arts Not So Live But Still Local, and to Oregon State Senator Betsy Johnson for all of her advocacy, particularly for the arts. Thanks to Astoria Visual Arts for the use of their gallery, to Ray Merritt for his engineering assistance, and to you, Coast Community Radio listeners, for your continued support of homegrown radio. Music this week is by The Hackles from their album A Dobrich Did As A Dobrich Should, and from Giants in the Trees from their self-titled first album and from Volume 2. For more information about events, check the community calendar on this station's website at coastradio.org. I'm Cindy Price. Let's do this again next Friday. Meanwhile, please be safe and well.